Okay, welcome back. We are here in a beer garden at Edinburgh's Jazz Stroke Fringe Festival. We still haven't quite figured out which one we're at yet. Up next is a rather bunged up Chris Cotter. Unfortunately, he's got a bit of a cold right now, so if he mumbles a bit, that's not his fault. So, what is Chris's favourite podcast?
Right, well, my favourite podcast was Jay Demarest's interview on functionalist religion and the substantive sacred. I hope that I've got that the right way around. I mean, I'm not going to be quite as eloquent, I think, as Jonathan or Louise have been in their responses. A lot of my preference is entirely personal, because it was one of the first interviews that I did, though not the first, but it was when I was in the United States at the Society for the Scientific Study of Religion's annual conference in Milwaukee. And basically, Professor Demarest was incredibly welcoming, and it was really generous of him to give up so much of his time at that very busy conference. To talk about the academic reasons for a bit, obviously I know Ethan flagged up very well in his response to it, to this interview, why should we just replace one term with another term? Why should we replace religion with sacred? It's still a bit obfuscating, etc. But I really feel that these two concepts, religion and the sacred, work really well in tandem, and Professor Demarest did a really good job in the interview of delineating what a sociology of religion is like and what a sociology of the sacred is like. I think at the end of the interview I ended up making a statement that I shall now take back. I said at the end of the interview, I always thought religious studies should be sacred studies. I'll take that back. I'll step back from that, because you know, that really wouldn't summarise my position as well as I would like to. I think the concept of the sacred, in a recent presentation I gave down in London at the NSRN conference, I was talking about three. We have two triads of terms. We have religion, secular, and non-religion, and we have sacred, mundane, and profane. And I think that these two triads really help us understand the dynamics that are going on. Stuff that is religious may not necessarily be sacred to people. Stuff which is non-religious may not necessarily be profane or secular. Non-religious stuff can be sacred, and religious stuff can be perfectly mundane. So I think Professor Demarest in this interview does a really good job of delineating the differences between substantivist and functionalist definitions. And that again is something that you do need right at the start of undergrad. And I think also the fact that those words were in the title has maybe meant that that podcast hasn't got the listenership it should have, because people see substantivist functionalist and go,
I tried when
don't
I
know
did
what
the,
that means.
I tried when I did the page, but there wasn't
He
was insisting on that it was the sociology of the sacred.
Yeah.
But
no, it's a perfect title, that's what I needed, but I feel that, you know, that essential distinction is one of the reasons why it should be listened to, but people will probably be put a little bit off by it. From a purely personal reason, I'll say that this is the interview that I've listened to 4 times, actually. Because he was just a lovely guy, and he's a perfectly listenable voice. And I know that my fiance will be annoyed with me for telling this story, but I'm going to tell it anyway. She couldn't get to sleep one night. She was wide awake, and I was like, listen to this podcast. This guy's got a lovely voice. You'll just love listening to it. And she listened to my interview with Jay Demarest. And at the end of the interview, she was still awake. He didn't lull her to sleep or anything, but she said, why did you have to keep butting in and interrupting him with questions? I could have listened to him all night.
Welcome to the Religious Studies Project, hosted by Christopher Cotter and myself, David Robertson. This podcast is produced in association with the British Association for the Study of Religions, and you can visit our website at www.religiousstudiesproject.com.
So today, we're joined by Professor Jay Demarest, the Emil Durkheim Distinguished Professor Emeritus of Sociology
at the University of Massachusetts, Amherst. Jay Demarath is the author of many books and articles in sociology and the sociology of religion, including Crossing the Gods, World Religions and Worldly Politics, and The Sage Handbook of the Sociology of Religion with James Beckford. Today, we're going to be talking about the relationship between the sociology of religion and the sociology of the sacred. So first of all, welcome, Professor Demarath.
Nice to be here.
Good, good. For the benefit of our listeners, I think if we could just go right to the basics to start off, never mind the sociology of religion, what is this sociology?
Well, sociology is variously defined. I have three sons who, when they were little, used to describe what I did in the neighborhood as study groups. And it is true that sociologists study groups, I guess, in a sense. We study the structure and culture of social phenomena at whatever level, whether large-scale, nations, institutions, organizations, or small-scale experiences and interactions that people have among themselves. It's a broad field.
I can imagine. How does one go about doing that? There must be tons of different methods involved in there. Could you maybe tell us a bit about
that? Tons of different methods and tons of different theories. But the methodology of the field assumes that there will be some kind of empirical analysis of the phenomenon at issue. These may involve surveys with questionnaires or interviews. They may involve observational studies. They may involve the use of census materials and demographic analyses. They may involve historical accounts. And then you have a variety of theoretical traditions in the field, which are apt for particular kinds of problems and particular kinds of analyses. So, sure, it's a big field. It has a lot of guns going for it. They're not all going off at once. It sometimes seems that way.
Okay. So before we talk about the sociology of religion, I think it'd be helpful if we got a handle on your understanding of what the term religion means. I know there are a lot of ways and you can't define it. But for you and your work, what is religion?
Well, I think for me, it is a phenomenon with three components. One, a kind of transcendent sacred commitment, which is reinforced ritually, and it is subject to a kind of collective, shared and enacted set of experiences. So religion has to have a sacred theology of sorts. It has to have ritual, and it has to have a collectivity. It's not something that one individual by himself or herself can have. There have to be two or more involved. Now, there are virtuosos, of course. There are religious prophets who think of themselves as brilliant individuals with new insights, and they can be, but it's not until you have a collectivity that, from a sociological point of view, you have religion, in my view.
Right, so the sociology of religion, then, basically, is what you've defined as sociology attached to
Absolutely.
This religion. So we don't need to go into that, but could you maybe give some examples, and this could open up a huge can of worms, but of sociology of religion applied theories, things which have actually come out of it?
Well, I have studied over my career religion at various levels. I've studied the relationship of social class to religious involvement, for example, looking at individuals from different class backgrounds, and presumably with different religious needs accordingly. But I've also studied the relationship between religion and power at the national level, or what Americans call church and state. And that's at a different level, but it asks the questions of how religion relates to power, how it relates to politics, and how it relates to the state. In all those cases, though, we're concerned with how religion is understood, how it's enacted, how it's performed, what kind of influence it has, either at the individual level or at the national level. What can we understand about it that people involved in it don't necessarily understand themselves?
So that's sociology of religion. What makes this difference from other approaches?
Well, in a sense, we are a peculiar breed. I found that people are made a little uncomfortable around sociologists of religion. The assumption is that if you're interested in religion, you're interested in it because you're religious. And therefore, you share all things religious, you're eager to go to anything that smacks of religion. That's not quite true. I mean, and we are interested in analyzing religion, not necessarily in practicing it. And the analysis of religion often makes people uncomfortable. It involves, in some sense, questioning the very things that they practice, the very things they believe in. And therefore, we are something of a breed apart and perhaps someone to be suspicious of.
A lot of my own work, as you know, is on the non-religious, so, secularization theory, etc. You know, you can be a secularization theorist without being a proponent of secularization, etc. It's always good to clear up that misunderstanding.
Well, I'm a secularization theorist, too. I think, really, most sociologists of religion are, but they understand secularization in a very different way. And I argue that it's not only a question of secularization, but sacralization. Just as things may become less sacred, they can become more sacred.
A question that I thought of last night after we're here at the Society for the Scientific Study of Religion conference in Milwaukee. So after sitting through a day of sessions, I added some questions to our interview. And one thing was, how do sociologists of religion make sure that what they're finding isn't just a product of their own imagination or of their own study? You know, if you go into something with a questionnaire, with set ideas and things, how do you test to make sure that you're not just finding what you wanted to find?
And that, of course, is where methodology comes in any scientific undertaking, social scientific, natural scientific, or whatever. If you don't have some kind of rigorous and disciplined methodology, if you don't have something that people can assess by looking over your shoulder, then you really don't have much at all. Then you may be falsely accused or rightly accused of simply flying by the seat of your pants, and that's not what we want to do. We are social scientists. We take our methods seriously. We take our theoretical positions seriously. And that's what distinguishes us from kind of armchair observers of the religious scene.
And that's all built into with the peer review and everything.
Absolutely.
Like that. Okay. So given the topic of this interview, I'm going to put it out there that maybe you aren't a fan of sociology of religion, per se?
Well, I'm not a fan in the sense that I think that the sociologists of religion tend to sell themselves short.
Okay.
They tend to focus sometimes exclusively on religion, but in doing so, they neglect a much wider set of sacred phenomena that have religious qualities, if you like, but aren't conventionally religious. As I like to put it, not everything that is sacred is religious, and not everything that is religious is sacred.
So you've brought in that term sacred there. Can we talk a bit more about it, where it's come from? I mean, people will use it in the common speech, etc., but does the sacred have an academic history, and what are we meaning here by sacred?
Not as much, although it is anchored to some extent in something that social science depends upon and takes very seriously, namely culture. every social gathering, every social entity, every society has some kind of cultural cohesion to it. It's what holds us together. It's what expresses our identity collectively. Now, earlier I defined the sociology of religion as requiring a transcendent sacred commitment. But there are non-transcendent sacred commitments. And when I say transcendent, I have in mind the kind of thing that people conventionally regard as critical for religion. A god, a godlike other world, higher calling, and so on. But there are sacred commitments, I think, that are not transcendent in that sense, except insofar as they are more compelling commitments for the individual. They are something that have a special place in the life of the individual, overriding other kinds of beliefs, other kinds of assumptions, over other kinds of commitments.
So in that sense, religious beliefs to an individual can be held sacred, or other things could be held more sacred than their
absolutely
religious belief.
Absolutely. Yeah. There are people with religious beliefs which I suppose are not sacred. I mean, they may be incidental to their lives. They may be assumptions about the world beyond, but they're not very important in what they do. There are people who are what I call culturally religious. They don't go to church. They're Christians. They don't believe in doctrine. And yet there is something about a religious legacy through their family that is important to them. They observe the holidays. They particularly enjoy the gift-giving associated with Christmas. They enjoy the table gathering at Thanksgiving in the case of Americans. But this is not so much a religious event per se. However, they are culturally religious. They still feel that this is something important in their life and is part of the continuity of their family traditions.
Something worth fighting for, something sacred.
Perhaps.
Maybe not religious.
Absolutely.
So here we are, sort of midpoint in our discussion, crux of it, I think. What would the sociology of the sacred be? Have you engaged in this sort of work? And how religion's quite a, whilst it's amorphous and difficult to define, you can still go out into the world and study religion because you've got places to go to, people who say I'm religious, you can ask them questions. So how do you go about finding, assessing, engaging with this sacred when there isn't, it's not visible?
Well, it's a good question, and it's a question that is only now, I think, beginning to be answered. There are ways of asking people about the commitments they have, and their relative priority for them, their relative degree of power and focus for their lives. And these may involve a whole variety of things. I mean, for some, a political party and ideology may be sacred. For others, a sports team, perhaps a rock group, maybe a family setting may be sacred in ways that go beyond the conventional. But my conviction is that most of us have convictions. Most of us have sacred convictions of one sort or another. And the question is, how do we assess them? I am concerned that if we focus just on religion, that's only one of many types of sacred commitments. And we focusing just on religion may neglect something broader, something much more powerful in the lives of many individuals.
So, are scholars deciding what is sacred for people, or are people saying, this is sacred to me? How do we negotiate that kind of...
Well, scholars certainly aren't saying what is or should be sacred, but they want to find out what people not necessarily regard as sacred, but behave as if they're sacred. So if you develop a kind of a checklist of behaviors that are associated with what might be a sacred commitment, you can find out If you ask people what they do, what they don't do, what they believe and what they don't believe, what they observe and don't observe, you can find out kind of roughly what the priority is of their commitments, the commitments in their life, and the convictions in their life. And they will differ from individual to individual, from category of individuals to another category of individuals. But certainly the individual has to be the person who tells you what's sacred. However, it may be tricky to begin to get him or her to focus on sacredness itself, and you may have to ask about it in ways that kind of sneak up on the topic. Because if you ask the man on the street, the woman on the street, what's sacred in your life, they're likely to be blown away by the question. So you have to develop some rapport and some understanding of what we're talking about.
That is a good opportunity to ask qualitative and quantitative research. Would a sociology of the sacred, could you assess it quantitatively, or is it, you know, is it more favored by a qualitative approach?
Oh, I think you can assess it both ways. I think there's almost nothing that can be assessed qualitatively that can't also be assessed quantitatively if one is imaginative enough in going about it. And it is a question of developing techniques that are rigorous, unbiased, but at the same time sufficiently insightful in covering a phenomenon so you know what you're getting. There's a difference between being reliable and being valid as a technique. And a valid technique is something that you measure in a way that really reflects what you want to observe, what you want to test and measure.
At this stage, I was wondering if you could tell us about some personal, well, not personal, but research that you've done that you would describe as sociology of the sacred, maybe just one project and how you went about it and what you found.
Well, let me tell you about a particular way in which the sociology of the sacred becomes instructive and in some ways controversial. Not long ago, I was a witness in a federal court case that involved a young woman who had a single gold ring and a pierced eyebrow.
Okay.
She worked as a checkout girl in a franchise store, and the order came down from the store's headquarters that people shall wear no adornments, no facial adornments whatsoever, neither tattoos nor jewelry. And the store called her in and said, "I'm sorry, you'll have to take off that ring." And she said, "I can't do that. That's important to me. I can put a Band-Aid over it." What do you call a Band-Aid in Britain?
A plaster,
that's right. And they said, "No, that won't work. Well, you're fired, basically." Well, she went to a lawyer, came back and said, "I think I've got a problem with being fired because it violates the freedom of my religion." Now, that's something very important in the United States. Mm-hmm. We have a First Amendment to our Constitution that says, "Congress shall enact no law respecting an establishment of religion, nor prohibiting the free exercise thereof."
Mm-hmm.
Well, the store owners, the store managers, were flabbergasted. "Your religion," they said, "what religion might you have that is related to an earring and an eyebrow?" She said, "I belong to the Church of Body Modification." Church of Body Modification. Does that sound conventionally religious? I don't think so. But it might be sacred. And therefore slide into religion. The relationship between the sacred and the religious is one in which there is some give and take. And the fact of the matter is that increasingly in our country, people who have sometimes bizarre sacred commitments nonetheless find that that qualifies them for the freedom of religion as a particularly important form of the sacred. That case was ultimately dismissed in court, but not because it was not a valid religion. No judge wanted to tangle with that.
Mm-hmm.
No judge wanted to tangle with that at all, because they knew that increasingly religion is defined in the broadest, most sacred sense, not in the narrowest sense. Lawyers would say, well, why don't you tell the court how Catholic-like were her religions? How much the Church of Body Modification resembled the Catholic Church or the Presbyterian Church or the Episcopal Church? Well, that's exactly what the first part of that First Amendment says you can't do. Mm. Congress shall enact no establishment of religion. That would have invoked an established religion as the criterion.
Mm.
So the courts have learned they have to have a very large umbrella over possible sacred commitments to avoid becoming entangled in the First Amendment and losing on that basis. The judges had no problem with her Church of Body Modification. That was not the grounds for turning down the case.
Right. So, like, it does have major implications, really.
Increasingly so. And it's not quite clear to me what's going to happen to the law about church and state in the United States, but there is an increasing tradition of honoring sacred commitments that go beyond religion. I'll give you another example. Beginning in the Vietnam War, there were people who wanted to qualify as what are called conscientious objectors.
Mm-hmm.
They did not want to go to war. They did not want to fight in that war in particular. But they were not particularly religious. They did have a sacred view that life itself was sacred, killing was not, and they were not going to be able to pick up a weapon and take it into battle against another human being. Judges had a problem with this because the tradition was to give conscientious objector status only to people from different religious groups who actually believed in non-killing, in pacifism, as a sacred tenet. These people weren't religious. These people didn't particularly belong to a religious group. The judges said, okay. Now, remember, they were under political pressure. By then, this was an unpopular war in Vietnam. The judges said, if your sacred pacifism occupies a place in your psyche that a religious conviction normally would, we'll accept it. And you can be a conscientious objector. That opened a very, very big door into all kinds of sacred commitments that might have standing under church-state law. Now, the courts have not returned to that quite, but they're moving back in that direction. And at what point now do we begin to draw the line between something that is secularly sacred or religiously sacred?
Mm.
It's an interesting question.
It's fascinating. You mentioned secular there. So one of the major proponents of I guess the term sacred would have been Eliade, with his sacred and the profane, and he would say, as I guess a lot of people would, that the sacred is always defined against something which is profane. And also Eliade ended up saying that the sacred manifested itself in the profane and the profane manifested itself in the sacred, and everything ended up getting very, very tangled up. And when you've got that other against which the sacred is defined, yet the sacred can manifest itself in the other, what does that do to the context?
Well, Eliade was borrowing from Durkheim there. Durkheim also distinguished between the sacred and the profane, and yet the two were related. You couldn't have something that was sacred without imagining the possibility that it would be profaned. It would be in some fashion contradicted. It would be traduced, as people might say. And similarly, how can you define something as profane if there's not something sacred being violated?
Hmm.
So there's no difficulty with that. But there's a third category. There's the sacred, the profane, and what one might call the secular, or the ordinary, the unremarkable, the taken for granted. That has become a much bigger bone of contention than sacred versus profane. Sacred versus secular is now a major issue in the sociology of religion.
So the secular isn't the opposite of the sacred. It's a simple lack.
Well, it's not the opposite in the sense that profane is.
Mm.
It doesn't contradict it. It doesn't violate it. But it is different in this, in another way. Rather than being something that one takes very seriously and one venerates as something divine, it is something that is merely ordinary, taken for granted, and no longer a major component in one's life.
So just like you can't have a sacred without a secular or a profane, you can't have a religion without what is not religion. Is thinking of the sociology of the sacred, is that just replacing a already contentious term with another one?
Well, except they're different terms. I mean, if you define religion in terms of transcendence and make that a necessary condition of religion, but not in the case of the sacred. Sacred conviction or commitment does not have to be transcendent in that sense. Mm. It does not have to refer to an otherworldly divinity of sorts. That's a difference. But religion is a category within the sacred. The sacred is an umbrella over many sorts of commitments, one of which may be religious.
We could go on talking for hours here. But I think I'll have to ask you one final question before we wrap up.